Good morning, everybody. It's great always to be here on Radio Rehab and introduce the community to people that are trying to do better a day at a time at keeping themselves clean and sober and keeping their minds clean thinking. And the guest today that I have is going to share her story of how that all took place for her, her addiction being raised in a family where there was alcoholism, which creates a lot of its own other issues before you even have your own addiction. And she's been clean and sober since, oh my God, August 29th of 2002. She just informed me this morning she's got 11 years now. She's growing up, Dina. And LaTanya's here, who also has 11 years, so there's a lot of sobriety here today. LaTanya is listening in, and we're going to have a discussion and talk with Dina, because LaTanya's going to start helping to hostess Radio Rehab. So we're broadening our horizons of keeping the message of recovery here for you every Saturday from 10 to 11, and LaTanya's going to have guests and just talk about the focus of staying clean and sober, which we're excited about. So they are here. Also, I just have one announcement. Randy called me from Rebos. Those of you that don't know what Rebos is, it's sober spelled backwards, Rebos, and it's the Narcotics Anonymous Club in Evansville. They're having a hot dog baked bean fundraiser today. Anybody is welcome to come over there to the club for hot dogs and food and lots of clean and sober fun. It's at 1043 North Fulton Avenue. That's the Narcotics Anonymous Clubhouse. It's right there across from Wesselman's on Fulton, I think on Fulton and Missouri. Yeah, the old Royal Superfood. So head over to Rebos and get yourself some hot dogs and baked beans. Well, Dina loves sharing her experience, strength, and hope, except when it's in front of a microphone. So hopefully when she gets started here, she'll forget there's a microphone, because she's got a story of incredible hope and perseverance and love for the program. So, Dina, thank you for coming. Oh, coming back from New York.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Coming back from New York, it was a great trip.
Why didn't you invite LaTanya and I to go with you guys? That's what I want to know.
You got the money?
Yeah, there you go.
You got money.
She's saving up for college, though.
How about next time?
Next time. Did you go to any meetings in New York?
We did not.
Yeah, no time, no. But they've got them on every block, I think, in New York City.
Yeah, well, I don't think that trip would have been possible if I wouldn't have gotten sober. I was so stuck in my addiction and so much fear that I didn't really get out of town or take many risks at all. I had a fear of people and economic insecurity.
All the time,
it talks about in the promises. And those leave us if we practice the program on a daily basis. So it's just a real gift. To get to go explore and be part of the journey.
Do you think those of us in sobriety do look at the world differently once we're sober? It's like you just don't take those things for granted. You take a vacation, it's like, wow, I've come here because of my sobriety.
It was wow. And the most amazing part that I was realizing as I was there was that I could actually be in the moment, that I could actually experience it. I wasn't, my thoughts weren't racing into the future or worrying about the past. It was like, wow, I can actually be in the moment. And I don't know if I would have, I think my first probably 2 or 3 years, I didn't have that, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, once I sobered up, I was a nervous wreck. And I think that's why I used, is because I was a nervous wreck. And when I was using, I think it helped me hate myself a little less when I was using, if that makes any sense.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Numb out the self. Zero-ness.
Yeah. It was, I just didn't know how to, pardon me, didn't know how to experience life.
No one taught you?
I don't think so. It was, I think the teaching was to just be the best person you could be, but there wasn't much guidance on how to be happy or to deal with emotions, which are, you know, sadness, happy,
nervous,
yeah, which turned into neuroses for me. But I could, you know, I learned how to hide that. You know, just it was for me a walking wounded with a smile on my face. And so, you know, I've learned how to deal with some of that today. And, I, you know, I'm not blaming my parents at all.
Right.
You know, they did the best they could, gave us an incredible upbringing. You know, my mom and dad worked very, very hard and are good people. But what I've experienced and what I know is that what I believe in our family is that alcoholism is generational.
Yeah.
And my dad was the alcoholic. He's passed on. And my mom was a para-alcoholic, which is a person who doesn't drink but has the isms of the disease. And so she was
living with an alcoholic.
And she was from alcoholism, and my dad was from alcoholism. My grandfather was an alcoholic, and my mom's mom was an alcoholic. So
multi-generational.
It's very generational. It gets passed on, and it's not intentional. It's just
biology.
Yeah, it is. It's encoded.
Yeah.
And so
you're from Evansville?
From Evansville, born and raised. And I'm one of six kids. I'm number five.
My God, you must be Catholic.
Catholic.
I met someone in Branson that had 12 siblings. They were Catholic. So there were six of you?
There's six of us.
Wow. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And, you know, my dad and my mom worked real hard, sent us to private schools, and we were clothed and fed well and kind of did a cadence march of doing what you were supposed to do and how you were supposed to do it. And you know, it was kind of militant in a way. But my dad wasn't an everyday drinker. He was kind of a binge drinker. So there was a lot of unpredictability. Mm-hmm. And so in that, most of us were hypervigilant to when is the bomb going to drop? We didn't know whether to be ready for a party or ready to for the bomb to drop and
hide.
Yeah, and I did a lot of hiding. You know, I kind of stayed out of the way. Some of my other siblings they challenged the rule. They challenged the iron fist, and I wasn't one of those. I kind of stood back and watched and saw what would happen, and so you know, I decided I wasn't going to do that. I went and hid, or I became very much a people pleaser and tried to do exactly what I was supposed to do and how I was supposed to do it. And what ended up happening was I was searching for approval and affirmation, and I think even when I got it, it still wasn't enough, and so I was always after it. I was always after, and I lost my own identity in doing that. It was always about doing something for someone else and not really learning about who I am or what my feelings are or what I need to do for myself. So
even before you were drinking, huh?
Even before I was drinking,
of coping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I was fueled by a lot of fear and just uncertainty and self-doubt. And I believe that you can raise a child with, you know, some self-esteem and give them unconditional love. It seemed in our family it was very conditional, you know, do as I say, not as I do type upbringing. But today I understand that better, and I've forgiven, and I hold no grudges, and I'm grateful. I know what triggers me today. You know, fear of authority and the need to people please are triggers for me. So I'm able to understand that those are old behaviors and old coping skills that I was able to use to help me get by, but I don't need them today. I can be myself, and it's okay to be me.
What a gift.
It's a gift. It really is.
So
thank God.
Before you were drinking and drugging, you were wired with insecurities and fears and
people-pleasing. I was wired that way, and I believe that's why I picked up. It was
relief.
A way to shut off the voices. It was a way to shut off the dialogue of I'm not good enough, I don't measure up, what more can I do? And that's how it seemed. So I picked up. My older siblings, we grew up in the 60s and the 70s, and so, you know, that was there was a lot of drugs and alcohol in those years, and you know, I know that there still are, but it was kind of a, I don't know, it was a revolution. And and to me, what it seemed to me was it was a way to be cool. You know, when I saw my older siblings and other people drinking and partying, and some of them could do that without having problems. But I thought it was cool, and I wanted to be part of that. And so I picked up probably at the age of around 12 or 13.
Wow, and seventh grade
with my sisters, actually. And
got to watch out for those older siblings.
Yeah, you do. You do. I have a sister that's younger than me, and she's 9 years younger, and that was probably a gift because she was too little to hang around. But
you older drunk sisters, right? Don't go away, Radio Rehab. We have to take a little bit of a break, and we're coming back to finish hearing Dina's story of the demise of her alcoholism and the beautiful recovery. We'll be right back. We
But it was mostly I drank outside with peers. It was like I said, it was kind of the cool thing to do. But it was I was very preoccupied with it. I wanted to get to it when I could, and we had access through brothers and sisters, or you know, just even. Were gutsy enough to walk up to somebody at a liquor store and ask them to buy alcohol for you. It wasn't as policed as it is now, and I'm glad that it is, because people are noticing, and there's a red flag if some young child is, you know, walking up to somebody at a liquor store and asking. Somebody to buy alcohol for them. I mean, that would send a red flag, hopefully, to someone. But so got into high school, and that seemed the thing to do, too. What I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous and Adult Children of Alcoholics is that we not only have a physical disease, but we have a disease of perception. And just the dis-ease of how I perceived things might not have been actually how they are. My view was kind of askewed. It was negative and one of just needing to fit in, and I felt like I never fit in. And I think that's kind of something that I hear in the rooms a lot. I never fit in. It felt like something was always wrong and I needed to fix it, but I didn't know how. So the alcohol and the drugs really quieted that down. It not only quieted me physically, but it quieted my all of the demons and the voices in my head. So I got into
Sounds
high
like
school.
Something anybody would want. It's
well,
tortured inside.
It was a torture, yeah.
A drink takes that away. Who wouldn't drink?
It was. There was also some normalcy, you know. I wasn't a very good student. However, I played sports, and I loved that. And I also got a lot of approval and attention for that. So,
You suck at basketball, though.
No, not really. remember, I beat you.
Oh, you tore me up
at the park in Owensboro.
Yeah, you're a heck of an athlete. So, but athletics gave you some positive attention.
Athletics gave me positive attention, and also gave me some self-esteem. Mm-hmm. And so, but in the where I come from, you know, in the 70s, and the people that I was growing up with and hanging out with, we would work hard and practice hard. We were pretty good at it, but we used alcohol as a reward, and so it was a party afterwards, and it seemed to always be on my mind to get to that. So I graduated from high school not with good grades. I was working at a theater at the time, so I had a job, and I also had access to money at this theater, and so I started stealing to afford my drinking and drugging, and was going to school. I just only went for a couple semesters because I got into a lot of trouble. I was just mainly focused on getting high and escaping. Now, did I know this at the time? No, it's just in reflecting. I think I was just existing at that time.
For the
just
buzz.
Kind of, yeah, just existing and going through the motions. And
nobody had intervened or told you to slow down? Or
oh, there were people saying...
Huh? plenty of people intervened. Who was listening?
Right.
Plenty of people were saying, well, especially my parents, and it, I don't know that I ever heard much of a, it wasn't spoken so much, it was a look. Mm-hmm. It was a look of, oh, you, something's different, or there wasn't a lot of communication. I didn't grow up with a lot of communication, so there was a lot of gestures and looks of disapproval. And now that wasn't so much in, you know, when I was experiencing the world outside the home. But what's difficult is that I pretty much knew from the inside that I was doing something that I really didn't need, or what that wasn't good for me, but I went against that. I was going against what I knew was not right or good for me. But that was part of the self-hate and self-doubt.
Yeah.
And so I was caught stealing money. My parents bailed me out of that. I had moved out of the house by that time, and so there was a whole series of consequences that went on there. It was my very first time that I had ever gone to see a therapist. They talked me into seeing a therapist and was asked some questions about my drinking and drug abuse. And I just really basically denied it. And I think the therapist really knew that I wasn't telling the truth, but there wasn't anything she could do.
Did anybody talk about your father's drinking?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, that wasn't ever.
So you kids got pushed into therapy, but nobody talked about Dad's drinking.
Nobody talked about it. I don't know. I don't know if that was part of the verbal communication in those days. I don't know. It just seems like maybe it wasn't brought up so much. It was more put on the individual.
And you were messing up in school, you were messing up at work, so they thought you needed help.
Right, right.
Yeah. He was functional, so to speak.
He was very functional, and I was pretty functional alcoholic as well. You know, I felt like if I could get up and go to work and earn a paycheck, that I really didn't have a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, my idea of an alcoholic was just some urine-soaked man in a trench coat carrying a bottle in a sack.
I think people still have that image of alcoholics.
You know, and
just downtrodden,
I
homeless.
Really had an image, I mean,
of an alcoholic.
Like you said, you know, just every day. I mean, I lived to go to work and get off of work and go get tore up.
Right.
I mean, I thought, you know, that was all good. And like you said, as long as I had a job, I paid my bills and stuff, wasn't nothing wrong with me.
Right.
You know,
right.
But like you were saying with your father thing, I'm not sure either back in those days that, you know, the alcoholism thing even was thought about.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't think of call people alcoholics or, you know.
Yeah, that was pre-Betty Ford Center.
Right.
Yeah,
there was a wreck on your way home, you know. A lot of times the cops took you on home, you know. Whatever.
Right.
You didn't go to jail and things like that. I think I remember the first DUI I got. I think my bill was like
$50.
Mm-hmm. You know, so.
Wow.
I mean, it just wasn't, a big thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is, like anything else, all this stuff been going on for ages, you know. Mm-hmm. And
it was just always swept under the rug. Nobody wanted to. It just seemed that it was going to be too hard to confront. And so it wasn't confronted. It was swept under the rug. Here, you get another chance, and then something happens, and here you get another chance, and you get another chance. But I think as time has gone on, and we've learned more about addiction and the mental illness, because it is a mental illness, and I didn't, I didn't want to buy into that at all when I first got into recovery.
That's the hard part to accept.
It is, and that's part of step two, just the insanity of it. Mm-hmm. And really the insanity of it, just simply put, is doing the same things over and expecting different results. And most alcoholics are really very stubborn, don't like to be told what to do or how to do it. And we have to learn things the hard way. I mean, we're just stubborn. But by the time I was 22, I had a wreck. I came out of it. I had turned my car over three times. My car flipped three times out in a field near Darmstadt, and I came out of it with a bump on my head and a sprained ankle. And I had a friend in recovery. He's passed on now. I can say his name, Sam Ryan. And Sam had found AA. He had found recovery. And I called him the next day after I came to, and I told him what happened, and he said, "Will you go to a meeting with me?" And this was in 1982. And I said, "Yes." And I had no idea what it was. Well, I did have an idea of what Alcoholics Anonymous was, but it wasn't what I found out. I had an idea that it was just a bunch of old men sitting around drinking coffee, smoking cigars, and being really pissed off that they couldn't drink.
Don't go away, Radio Rehab, because Dina's getting ready to tell us about her story of getting through a friend, just like Ebby and Bill Wilson in the Big Book. A friend talked to her about his AA experience, and she went with him. We'll be right back. So, Dina, you were talking to us about Sam, your Ebby, bringing you into the rooms of AA for the first time.
Wow, I had never thought about that before, the correlation of Ebby and Bill. But Sam was my Ebby. And he took me to my first AA meeting in 1982. And I remember being very nervous. I can still remember walking into that room over at St. Ben's, Saturday morning, 10 o'clock meeting. It was the upstairs meeting. And I remember the love and the acceptance that I felt there. It was so overwhelming that it scared me. I didn't know. I felt like somebody wanted something from me because I was being hugged and, hi, welcome, and come in. And I felt like I was supposed to give something back.
You like, looked what, like you were in shock.
I was in shock.
Like the Home Alone look.
I was just like, what have I walked into?
Is this real?
Is this real? And do I have to be real? Because I don't know how to be real.
Especially real warm like that without a drink.
Wow, exactly. Ooh. Yeah, I had probably not had any alcohol for maybe 12 hours.
Coming off a crash, too.
Yeah.
Flipping your car 3 times. Lord.
Right. But it was the first time I met you, Lisa.
Yeah.
And, you know, our friendship developed from that day.
That first hug.
Yeah. And I remember, I don't remember what I said in the meeting. I remember crying a lot. But people loved me, hugged me, told me to come back, and gave me phone numbers. And I remember making a commitment that day saying, I'm never drinking again. And I remember Sam saying, no, whoa, 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 you know. And 2 days later, I was drinking. And I felt ashamed and scared, but I didn't know about the phenomenon of craving. I didn't know about the body, mind, and spirit part that we learn. I wasn't ready to stay to learn yet. I wasn't ready. And I didn't know that at the time. I was still running on self-will and fear.
The roaring 20s.
Yeah, exactly. I was 22. And you know, started drinking again, was got a job, worked in the optical field that I'm in now, and it was in the wholesale part. So found a job at a place where there was people that partied. By the time 3 o'clock rolled around, we had the sinks full of ice and beer, and we were getting primed to go out. And this pretty much went on, I'd say, 3-4 days a week. And I stayed in that for a while. In 1985, my dad died. He died suddenly, and it really, it just seemed to change. It changed everything. It changed our whole family dynamic. You know, my dad was the king. And you know, even though I was out of the house, you know, I loved and adored that man, but I was also scared of him. Mm. And then all of a sudden, he died, very suddenly. And I really believe that's when my alcoholism really took off, because I didn't know what else to do but drink.
Yeah.
I mean, I really think I crossed the line. And I mean, I was drinking alcoholically before then, but it was my way of coping with the loss and the fear. You know, I watched my mom. She was shocked. You know, her partner was gone. She still had a daughter that my little sister was 15, and she still had to put her through school. And so anyway, it was it was tough. And so continued to drink. I was still working. Was getting in relationships that didn't last long, mostly just relationships that I correlated love and sex, and so it was my thinking was just so screwed up. By the time I was 30, I had hit a bottom again, and I knew about AA, and I tried it again at 30. And I stayed in, I think, for, to the best of my recollection, about 6 months. And then it started getting real close again. And people were saying, have you gotten a sponsor? Have you started working the steps? And that scared me. And I wasn't ready to face it. I could do 1, 2, and 3. I thought I could, but when I got confronted on step 4, I wasn't going to do it. I didn't want to look at me. I was willing to point my finger at everything and everyone else. And I remember saying, if you had my life, you would drink too. If you had what happened to me happen to you, you would drink too. But I wasn't ready or capable of facing any of that yet. And so went back out after about, I would say 6 months of sobriety. But every time I came into the rooms, every time another seed was planted, there was something else that I learned along the way. And AA was so important to me. I was so amazed by it, and so I liked it, but I just didn't know if I could do it. I always had this thinking, even as I was a child, I remember everybody else can do it but me. And so I really liked what the people had. I just wasn't willing to walk through what I needed to walk through to get to what they had.
The people you loved had that, whatever it is, I think, and you knew that they had it and were transformed.
Transformed.
I think you wanted that, but when that AA accountability came, you dart.
That's right. When accountability and responsibility came, when it was time for me to step up.
Program of action. Yeah,
when it was time for me to step up to the plate. I got scared. I have this thing about perfectionism. If I don't do it perfect, then I won't do it.
Yeah.
You know, and I get stuck in that, and I'm really working on that, and I'm grateful that I know that I have that type of thinking. And so today I know it's okay for me to make mistakes, and it takes what it takes to get exactly where I am today, and can accept that, in the long version of the Serenity Prayer, it says accepting hardship as the pathway to peace. Mm-hmm. Well, I never had that, any of that type of thinking, none of that. I had no spiritual way of thinking or behaving, or I didn't have that in my heart or my head. But by the time I was 41, I had lost 2 jobs. I'd been fired from 2 jobs as a direct result of my drinking. Many lost relationships. My family and my employers were disgusted with me. I was disgusted with myself. So by the time I was 41, I was ready to surrender. I remember thinking, wow, I am 41. Is this going to be my legacy? Is this what I'm going to turn into? I knew I was an alcoholic, and I would say, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Pour me another drink. Pour me another drink. You know, and I've heard that in the rooms, and that really applies to me. I so identified with that. But when it finally came down to a real surrender, I had compiled and gathered all of those times that I had come into the room. I had done in 1992 an IOP, an intensive outpatient at Stepping Stone, and that gave me a whole lot of information about the disease.
Treatment works, doesn't it?
Treatment works.
Yeah.
Treatment really works. And so I had learned a whole lot. And so by the time, and it was, what I didn't realize is that God was in all of that. I had no idea that the God of my understanding was in every bit of that. And so I was ready to surrender and walked into the rooms, picked up a white chip, and my journey began. My whole life changed. And I've read this before, and I hear this in the rooms. You know, we first sober up, everything gets better. It really does. I mean, I was pink clouding, and it was wonderful, and I was so relieved not to be drinking. I was so relieved not to be drinking. I had made a commitment, and I was hanging around people that were helping me stick to the commitment. Go ahead, Lisa.
Oh, you were, yes, fired up and ready to go to any length to stay sober. Don't go away, Radio Rehab. We'll come back and hear about Dina's sobriety. We're back talking to Dina about her story of recovery and her functional alcoholism that she finally surrendered to and came to AA, and you have been fired up about Alcoholics Anonymous since, and that's been 11 years. So, Dina, what keeps you fired up? How do you hang on to this thing, this gift that you said God gave you?
Well, it's a one day at a time gig, and I only learned that through Alcoholics Anonymous and the people that have gone before me and the ones that are doing the deal. And I guess, how do you do it? I was so committed to not drink. I knew that it was my demise, and so I was willing to go to any length to not drink. But it's part of, I guess, just practicing and knowing that I can't let myself slide too far away. Otherwise, I will lose the gift of, because it's all in my thinking. If I get around people that aren't doing what the program suggests, then because most humans are imitators, you know, we imitate each other. So I need to be around people who are staying sober, practicing the program, because that kind of energy, they give it back to me. Believe me, I've had times where I haven't gone to meetings or picked up the big book or have gotten real negative, not so much drink threatened, but serenity threatened, you know. And if I stay serenity threatened too long, then I might pick up a drink.
Yes.
And I pray every day that I don't pick up a drink. I thank my higher power for recovery, not only recovery from drugs and alcohol, but also from just the effects of growing up in an alcoholic home. You know, there's a lot of effects. We've been affected and can, you know, really hurt and stain the psyche. I was saying earlier, I read this, and it says, I think it was in a meditation book that I read. It says, at first it gets better, then it gets worse, then it gets different. Mm-hmm. And it's been getting different. And I think what's different is that I'm more willing to accept things today that might have really, I have control issues. I have the thoughts of how I think people should act or how things should go in my life. And I think I've become a little more flexible. Loving and forgiving myself, learning to love myself, has allowed me to see love and light in other people. If I'm having a hard time or am serenity threatened, you know, one of the things my first sponsor told me was go help somebody else. It's, you have to get outside of yourself to get away from the obsession of the thinking of staying in the negative thinking. And the selfish part is that it's all about me. That's the selfish part. And I never got that. Never understood that. So there's tools and there's principles. And today I try to live a principled life. Do I do that perfect all the time? No. But I think in the times that it's not perfect, that's where the lesson is, and that's when I'm really learning. I think that's where the truth is. Mm-hmm. I've been given so many gifts just to be able to sit here. You know, if you would have told me 11 years ago that I'd be sitting on Radio Rehab
5 years ago
with Lisa and LaTanya talking about my experience, strength, and hope, I would have said, no way.
Yeah.
But I'm willing to take more risks today. I'm willing to walk through some of the fears that I have today. And it's only because you guys are standing on the other side, holding out your hand and saying, come on, it's going to be okay. And I've been able to hold out my hand to other people and say, it's going to be okay. If I can do this, you can do this.
So it sounds like the real theme here is to come out of isolation.
Come out of isolation.
You got hurt in relationships, you got to get well in relationships. And it sounds like you came out of your isolation and grabbed, and let other people grab you.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
So that's it right there.
The healing begins when we risk coming out of isolation. Mm. It's true. And that's from ACOA. And I only felt safe to take that risk is because I trusted AA. I trusted the fellowship. I mean, there's parts of it, you know, there are some people that you don't trust, but you start learning. Your intuition starts coming alive again. You start nurturing. And that's part of what I believe my higher power is today. I believe in the big book, it talks in the spiritual experience about, it says, we have tapped an unsuspected inner resource. And in the rooms we talk about, we will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. And I believe that unsuspected inner resource for me, how that works for me, is that God is intuition. My HP is inside, and if I tap into it, I can get through whatever I need to get through. And to be okay with, it's okay to have pain. It's okay. I'm going to get through pain. I'm going to get through uncomfortable. I'm going to get through tough times. You know, sometimes when those things are so big, you think it's going to last forever. But really,
we need those things, though, to grow.
Yeah. We need those things to grow. That's exactly
right. You are higher powered.
HP.
Thank you, Dina, for coming.
We thank you for
keep
asking.
Talking forever. Thank you for being a friend to Radio Rehab. I hope we're passing on some hope. I'm sure we are to some people that are listening.
And thank you for allowing me.
And Miss Lisa today.
We'll Miss
to
Lisa
to you next time.
She well, or you can have her back maybe just individually.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, she's got a great story. But it's
all
been an
stories.
Honor and a privilege. Thank you for letting me sit here with you.
Thanks for letting us grab each other's hands. I love you to pieces.
I love you too. Thank you.
And LaTanya, you're on next week, baby. You ready?
We'll be here.
LT's going to be here.
Yep, hosting the Radio Rehab Show. All right.
I love you both.
Love you. Don't forget Rebos on Fulton Avenue, 1043 North Fulton's got hot dogs and baked beans and lots of good fellowship going on over there for Narcotics Anonymous. Head over there today. And don't forget between now and next week to do the next right thing.